actually be really convenient if I didn't have stuff like
this. If it worked out. Okay, so let's begin Parsha Bo, this week's Parsha. And the title is From Egypt to Germany, Reparations and War Crimes. So we're going to start with a little history, a little background, which is interesting. The first time I looked into this and thought about this and read about this was when I read Menachem Begin's, one of his biographies, which was written by Daniel Gordas, I believe. Very nicely done. And he brings in one of the chapters there a whole discussion about Menachem Begin's fierce opposition to taking money and taking reparations from the Germans after World War II in all the years following. And this was kind of a general approach of his, and he had an opposer who was David Ben-Gurion, who took the opposite approach. This is just one article. We're not going to read through the whole thing. Just you can look at one or two of the lines. And there's a sign here in the picture on the left side, which Menachem Begin protesting against the reparations, and the sign reads, "Nimcher acherpa," right? Our honor, "Kvodeinu lo yimcher bekesef," our honor shall not be sold for money. "Dameinu lo yechopar be," I don't even know what that word says. "Our blood should not be atoned by goods." Okay, mechorot, I think it says. So we shall wipe out the disgrace, which was basically this campaign to not accept the reparations. Now, obviously, the State of Israel wouldn't really be able to be where it is today in terms of realities on the ground. Just take, for example, the Navy, okay? The Israeli Navy, the submarines that the Israeli Navy has are built, made, manufactured in Germany. And that was part of the package of reparations. You can go on and on, all the Mercedes that you see around the country, taxis, everywhere, taxis, buses, you know, military vehicles, on and on. We would be far worse off in terms of certain basics that the country needed, especially in the early years, to be able to function. Okay, railroads, trucks, buses, you can read it here. So Menachem Begin was very, very strong against it. He said, if you look kind of halfway down, he said, "When the Haganah fired on us with their cannons, they gave the order, no, referring to the 1948 incident. I'll tell you today, give the order, yes, this will be a war of life or death," okay? You know, "Ghosts around the Knesset, as in the days of Rome, when the Romans wanted to set up an idol in the Holy Temple, the Jews came from all corners of the country surrounding the building and said, 'Over our dead bodies, this Knesset, I say, there are things in life that are worse than death. We will give our lives, we will give our families, we will say goodbye to our children, but we will not accept money from Germany. I know that you, Ben-Gurion's government, have power." That time, Ben-Gurion was the prime minister. "You have prisons, camps, an army, police force, detectives, artillery, machine guns. I know you can drag me off to a concentration camp. We will sit together with them. If necessary, we will die together, but we will not accept reparations in Germany." You know, anyone who's read the history of Menachem Begin, this is the type of person he was. Fiery, blunt, unapologetic, very strong about the, you know, the Israel needs to be independent. Israel needs to be stand on its own two feet. He was suspended from Knesset for this speech, by the way. That's in the next paragraph. And despite his strong words, the vote, you know, they brought it to a vote and it passed. So over the years, and even still today, I believe Germany's still paying out these reparations. And it is a very difficult topic, and I want to look at it from the perspective of the Parsha, where we left Mitzrayim with a lot of stuff that belonged to the Mitzrayim, and how that plays out in the Mefarshim, in the Pesukim themselves. So it's going to be, in a few moments, we're going to get into a little bit of a Tanakh study.
So just a quick question.
Yeah.
When we say reparations, we're talking about like large sums of money paid directly toward the state of Israel, or small, like incremental checks that are sent to survivors around the world?
So it's both. Reparations includes
like
both.
In this case, we're
yeah.
About
yeah.
Can
we're
I
talking about both.
I ask a historical question.
Yeah.
Was like Yetziat Mitzrayim time, like the end of the Egyptian Empire, around then? Or did they succeed for a lot longer? Because that's interesting.
It's a hard,
I don't think it was.
Yeah, I don't think it was. And I
also, yeah.
I think it's a hard question, because when you say the Egyptian Empire, you also have to figure out who was in power before. There's a lot of historical debate about that
also
as well.
Were like several different kingdoms, like
Yeah.
This the was Greeks like, and right, the over through the Greeks.
When you say Egyptian, right, what does that include? Like, how do you define, right?
There was also a southern and northern kingdom that were, like, unified. And
so let's see. This is interesting. If you turn to the next page, I just recently went through this book called Killing a King, which is a story of the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, who in many ways was the opposite, exact opposite of Menachem Begin. Many, many, many ways, which could be a whole other topic of discussion. And in chapter 6 of the book, when things were starting to get more intense post-Oslo, so we're basically talking end of 1994, 1995, Rabin appointed a new head of Shabak, that's here in the text on the right side, and there was basically the beginning of this extremist camp that was subtly calling for an end to the government. No one was like publicly coming out and saying they wanted to assassinate the prime minister, but it was definitely getting more intense from the the backlash from the right wing in Israel. So because of this, there was this new kind of policy around security, around the prime minister, and they were rethinking all the different ways that they secure, do security, public events, and things like that. And one of them was about armored vehicles. This was the discussion. Yitzhak Rabin, up until that point, had not been riding in an armored vehicle. And the head of security basically said, I think you should be in an armored vehicle. And he refused. That time, there was actually a lot of bus bombings taking place, particularly during this time when the suggestion was made. I think there were two or three in succession in like a two-week span. It was a very, very difficult time in Israel. And to boot, the company that was making these armored vehicles was Mercedes. And Yitzhak Rabin, being who he was politically, despite his differences, with maybe Menachem Begin, he felt very strongly against having a vehicle. And here's the words here in the second paragraph. He says, Kilon decided to order an armored car. Israeli prime ministers to date have been chauffeured in regular American-made vehicles, usually Chevrolet Caprice. Agency appointed a team to pick the right model. Most secure cars in the world were made by Mercedes, etc. And still, 50 years after the Holocaust, ordering a German car for Rabin was out of the question. Okay? He was against it. So they ended up getting him an armored Cadillac, which was more expensive because they weren't getting it as a gift. They had to pay for it. And Rabin also says, I didn't have it in this quote, he says, why should I drive in an armored car when Jews are being blown up, on buses? He felt very, and he was a military person, and he was kind of a macho type of personality that way. So it's a sensitive issue, and it's a sensitive issue to this day, especially when you speak to survivors. This is not a passing judgment on anyone who owns a German-made car, but there's sensitivities about this, and some people speak very, very strongly.
It's not like because it was from Germany or because they got it cheaper.
Yeah, because it was from Germany. He didn't want to go around in a car like that.
It had nothing to do with getting it for free.
No, I don't
think
so. You
said it was also, why would he get an armored car if
it was two different things, but yes, yeah. Which one he gave more weight to is an interesting question, but. Anyway, so a few more kind of just musings on this. Rav Schechter in a sefer called Nefesh HaRav, where he brings a lot of teachings from Rav Soloveitchik, he quotes that Rav Soloveitchik used to speak about this. I'm here in source number one. He says, Zichurani he'ech shedarash Rabbeinu b'rabim neged kabbalat tashlumei d'mei ha'pitzuyim mi'Germania. It's the reparations. Mishnei ta'amim, two reasons. Ha'achad, shalei yukablu eimet ha'argasha, shik'ilu bazeh, hi mikaprim v'yotzim yedei chobar ashmatam. So Soloveitchik felt very strong against it. He said, we're going to make them feel that, they can just atone for their sins by paying us off, paying us back, number one. And he felt like we shouldn't give them the wrong message, that they can just get away scot-free, or whatever, atone for their sins by just paying up. So this was not going into this right now, but this is a concept that Rav Soloveitchik expands upon in Kol Dodi Dofek. Refer you to that book to see more on this issue, where he builds this idea based on the Rambam, based on Rav Chaim Salvechik said that Amalek is an ideology, and any nation in history that espouses this ideology can be formed into a modern day Amalek. He was talking in 1956, if anyone wants to double check on that, but it was around the time, and he was talking about certain Arab Muslim surrounding countries which were espousing certain things against the state of Israel, and he came out with this talk where he said essentially that, you know, so he's putting Germany and the Nazi regime into this category of Amalek. V'shamati shachar barabesh shanim heviyar rabbeinu le'achad mitamadav sheulai hochicha historia she'em dato v'dato bezeh lo ayu nechonot. And then after time, Rav Salvechik seemed to go back on what he had said, and he said, look, history showed that the Germans really were changing and they were really helping the state of Israel, etc. And he kind of went back on what he had said originally. Okay, I'm not going to go through the other small pieces here. This is some discussion in source number 2 and source number 3 from different thinkers. One's like Shayla that was asked about purchasing products made in Germany, whether there's, that's like buying something that's like a cheirem. There was a cheirem that some poskim put in place after the Spanish Inquisition. You can't do business spent with Spain and things of that nature. So would there be, pardon?
Some people still don't travel to Spain.
And some people still don't travel to Spain because of that. And this type of thing maybe should be in place in Germany. And he basically said, you know, we're not making new halachas, we're not making new ideas, and any way to call them Amalek is already, it's a little bit of a jump, perhaps. Lubavitcher Rebbe in source number 3 has a similar type of comment where he was asked along the same lines about buying products, and he comes out with a similar type of approach. Again, it's more like hashkafa and sensitivity than it is necessarily halachic psak about this. But it is important to keep all that in mind because it's not. We're going to look at it now from the Tanakh perspective, but it is you just pass me the I have one in here that I wanted to work with, this one. Okay, I have my notes on this. Okay, so let's begin.
What does
chulsha mean? Chulsha is weakness, right? It would show a certain weakness. That's his point. In his discussion. So in source number 4, we have the first source, which is when Hashem promises, essentially, Abraham in the Brit Ben Betarim, that although your descendants will go down to be in slavery in Mitzrayim, or somewhere, they will leave with great wealth, right? They're going to leave with great wealth, and that's going to be part of the story. And again, you look at this on the simple level, the simple reading of this piece of history, is that we need money to establish a nation. We're going to be commanded to build a mishkan. We're going to be in need of basic funds to be able to run the nation and run the beginning of a new enterprise of a people. And that's not something that is just going to come out of thin air. It's got to come from somewhere. So Hashem made it possible, so we shouldn't suffer. Why should we suffer that we don't have the capital when we leave Mitzrayim? Hashem made it such that this would come about. The way it came about is very strange. So that's what I want to explore for the rest of the time today. So in source number 5, which is really the beginning of the story, Hashem already, before there's Makot, before there's a warning to Paro, before all of that, Hashem is speaking to Moshe in their first conversation, and he says to Moshe, what's going to happen? Here's what's going to happen. And I'm going to kind of give you a view forward of what's actually going to unfold. So Hashem's going to make it such that the Mitzrim are going to find favor. Chen is the way that the language is used. They're going to find chen in the eyes of the Jewish people, so that when you go, you're not going to go away empty-handed. And the lashon there's v'sha'ala isha mishchenta. Each woman shall borrow from her neighbor, objects of silver, gold, clothing. You'll put these on your sons and daughters, and you're going to leave Mitzrayim with all of this stuff. So the big question here is, sounds like we stole it, right? Sounds like we took it. Borrowing without permission is called stealing. In Bava Kamma terminology, although there's a little bit of debate on that, even in the Gemara. But so let's ask two questions. Number one, how is this justified? Number two, that's the less problematic one. Number two, why does it have to be this way that they're going to love us, that they're going to find favor in our eyes, that they're going to be like, we love you so much that we're going to give you all our stuff? Why did Hashem set it up and tell Moshe in the first place that when you leave, just know they're going to come to you and say, here, we love you, take all our stuff. Why did it have to be that way? So the Rashbam, just to answer question number one, there's two main approaches. There are others, but we're going to look at just two approaches. One is the Rashbam, here at the bottom of the page, where he writes that the She'ela here is not in the form of borrowing, but it's in the form of a gift, a matana. And when something is given as a gift, it's not with the intention that it's going to come back to the owner. So after all, God had encouraged the people to ask for these gifts. The Torah telling us in Pasuk Chaf Aleph that Hashem would make the people favorably disposed toward the Bnei Yisrael so that they would not refuse each such request. This, the principal meaning of the verse, effectively signs as the heretics who speak of the Jews borrowing and not giving back these trinkets. Now, just recently, in every couple of years, it comes up in the news that the Egyptians are suing I didn't put it in here, but there's a few places you can find this. The Egyptians are suing the Jewish people for stealing, right? And they have a whole calculation, how much money they took out of Mitzrayim, how many people were living there, and how much the inflation of the, how much it would have cost then, how much it would cost now, trillions and trillions of dollars. So it's based on the Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin in source number 6. That's what it's based on. I don't know if their court case is based on that. I don't even know if they're aware of it. But the Gemara in Sanhedrin brings a different answer. So the first answer is that it was a gift. Second answer is reparations. Let's see how the Gemara deals with this. Mitzrayim came to debate with Yisrael in front of Alexandrus Mukdon, also known as Alexander the Great. Chachamim allowed Gaviha to answer. So Mitzrayim said, Vayish Vayash Ilum, right? Which implies that it was to be given back. So return the gold and silver that you borrowed. So Gaviha said, you're using the Torah, you want to bring me a Torah source, I'm going to bring you a Torah source. You enslaved us for 400 and, it wasn't actually 430 years of total slavery, but the time away in the Brit Ben Betarim, right, that was said, Moshav B'nei Yisrael, ta-ta-ta, in Mitzrayim, you owe us wages for 600,000 people working for 430 years. So Mitzrayim said, all right, we need 3 days to think about this, and they didn't find an answer. In other words, if you look in the footnote, Rabbeinu Bachai spells this out in his commentary on in Perek Yud Aleph. He says, "V'ein ze gnevat da'at shitzaveh ba'kodesh baruch hu asasham." It's not gnevat da'at. Gnevat da'at means, right, that you're making them think that you're going to give it back. It's not actually a trick. Aval hayad davar mutar lahem. It was completely permitted. Sharei avodah shasulam ein la'erech ein la'schar melacha v'shavya sofa tachlit. You can't even calculate what the dollar value is on the amount of work that the Jewish people did when they're in Mitzrayim. So you can't even say that they're even paying them back to the amount that would equal the amount that they worked. So Lama said, this is just an interesting Rabbeinu Bachai in light of what we mentioned at the beginning, because this was the argument of a lot of the politicians in Israel who didn't want to take reparations from Germany. They're going to say whatever amount the Germans try to pay, there's no dollar value to pay back on the murder of 6 million Jews. You can't put that into a value amount that would pay that back. So that was kind of part of this opposition. So that's a little bit on number one. The question is number two. Why did it have to be that the Mitzrayim were going to turn to the Jews and say, we've found favor in your eyes, right? And we're going to see this term, chen, repeats itself in a few different places in the story. And that's exactly how Hashem wanted it to be. The question is, why is that? So let's start, now we're into this week's parsha, source number 7, Shmot Perek Yud Bet. So in Shmot Perek Yud Bet, right after Makkah Bechorot, you have the description of the Jewish people starting to leave Mitzrayim. And it says right there, Pasuk Lamed Vav, Hashem, right, disposed the Mitzrayim favorably, Matzuchein, in the eyes of people, and they let them have the request. So they got their stuff, and even Rashi on the spot here says, They lent them, right? Even what the Bnei Yisrael didn't request, the Mitzrim gave to them. So, you know, he says, give me one. And they said, no, take two. They just wanted the Jewish people to get out. So why did it have to be through this mechanism? The Mitzrayim would love Bnei Yisrael. There's another occasion of the same idea right after Makar Choshech, which is also from the beginning of this week's Parsha. And that's where it says, in source number 9, we'll start with source number 9, and then we'll go back to the Ramban. So in source number 9, this is Shmot Perek Yud, right at the beginning of this week's Parsha, actually right after Makat Arba, we have Makat Choshech, so I think it's like the second Aliyah. And Paro brings Moshe in, and he says, leave, right? Right after Makat Choshech, Paro says, get out of here, right? And you can go, but leave behind your animals. Leave your animals behind. Even the children can go with you. So this is already steps ahead from where Paro was after earlier Makot. Earlier Makot, either Paro wasn't willing to let anybody go. He was just completely, whatever you want to call it, unaffected, indifferent. You know, depending on which Rishonim, how you learn Paro hardening his own heart and his reaction, how you learn that whole story. But at the end of the day, Paro is not impacted by this, and his reaction is, now you guys mean business, I'm going to let you go, but I want to hold ransom your animals, I'm not letting you take them with them. Moshe says you can't do that, because we need the animals to bring korbanot. So we're going to take them with us, and nothing's remaining behind. And we need to take all of them, because we don't know which korban Hashem's going to ask us to take, so we're going to take all the animals with us. That's in Pasuk Chavav. And then Paro says, basically, no, I'm not letting you do it. Like, get out of my palace, get out of my house, take care never to see me again. For the moment you look upon my face, you shall die. So Moshe's response, you're right. That's true, Paro. What you said is exactly right. Next time you think you're going to see me, you're not really going to see me. You're never going to see me again. So that's okay. So if you look at the Ramban, it's fascinating. The Ramban says, right after Makat Bechorot, where it says that Paro went to call Moshe, right? What does it say? Does Paro ever find Moshe again? So if you look at the Psukim, it doesn't appear that Paro ever actually finds Moshe. Even Rashi there says in that story that Paro was like running up and down the streets and he was like calling out, where does Moshe live? Where does Aaron live? So it's not even clear from the text that Paro ever even found or stumbled upon Moshe and Aaron. And that's because Moshe told Paro he's never going to see him again. So what the Ramban writes here is Lo Sif Od Reot Panecha. This is in source 8. Pa Macheret Acharei Tzeiti Ki B'Makat Bechorot Lo Ra'ahu. That's exactly what happened. He didn't see him. Ki Tam Vayikra LeMoshe LaAron Shalach Ad Petach Beitam V'Tzak B'Choshech Kumutzu Mitochami O Shalach Lehem Al Yad Mitzrayim Shnem Barba Hem V'Tachazak Mitzrayim Al Am L'Maher L'Shalcha Min Ha'aretz Yitachin Shemar Lo Sif Od Reot Panecha Beheichacha. So that's a different parish that he brings there, but what's coming out here is this whole thing was set up, right? That Paro's going to actually be having a very different reaction than the people. We're going to see it comes out here in the next part. So if you look back in source 9, this is already the next perek. So it's Perek Yud Aleph now, at the bottom of the paragraph, Sukim Aleph through Gimel. So Moshe is standing before Paro, right? He's still standing there. He hasn't left the palace yet. And then Hashem comes to Moshe, and he says the following, right? I will bring out one more plague upon Paro and upon Mitzrayim. After that, he shall let you go from here. And look what it says. And when he lets you out, he's going to drive you out one and for all, and that's it. Tell the people to borrow. Here it is. Each man from his neighbor and each woman from hers, object of silver and gold. And then it says, Hashem disposed the Mitzrayim favorably toward the people. Now, as Moshe stands in front of Paro, receiving this last message to give to him, right, Hashem tells him, say to the Bnei Yisrael, borrow the kelim, borrow the gold and silver, right, from the Mitzrim. Then it says, Hashem put the chain in the eyes of the people, chain of the people in the eyes of Mitzrayim. So the question is, what was the chain? What was the love? So if you look at the Ramban, on those psukim, turn to the next page, in source number 10, this is not a reference to the chain of giving the gifts, because Hashem had already made this love, or this chain. Whereas the chen for the gifts is only going to come later. So what's the chen here? What is being referenced here that there's going to be this favor that the mitzvim are going to find in the eyes of the Jews? And the answer is, says the Ramban, very clearly, he says, Yeshamim ki beinea am, im mitzrayim velo amar beinei paro beinei avadav, it's specifically to the people, meaning the Egyptian people, ki Hashem amatzet libo, Hashem hardened Paro's heart to an extent that what? That Paro wasn't going to be attracted in the same way to the Jewish people that the Mitzrim were. Keneged Moshe v'diber lo shelo kogein ata pamaim. So Paro's not speaking nicely to Moshe. Hashem wanted Paro to come like on begging on his knees for them to leave. That was what Hashem wanted with Paro. Paro needed a different type of result for him. Ki retza Hashem, this is the key line in the second line. Ki retza Hashem sheyavo elav yishtachavu lo keba adam elsono. But with everybody else, meaning the Egyptians themselves, what did Hashem make them do? All of a sudden, these were the people that brought all the plagues on them. Now they love them, and they're giving them all their stuff. So it doesn't make any sense. These are the people that they hated so much, and Moshe brought the makot, and now they love them. And the only exception was Paro. So why should this be so? Why should this be so? So the answer seems to be as follows. At the beginning of the book of Shemot, and this is actually almost the opposite of what we spoke about a few weeks ago, we were talking about how the Jews tried to distinguish themselves when they were in Mitzrayim. Not all the Jews followed the rules of trying to distinguish themselves. Not everybody kept their names, not everybody kept their dress, not everybody kept their language. And the Midrash that the Beit HaLevi quotes here in Source 12 takes the assumption, and this isn't the only Ma'amar Chazal that we can quote, there are a lot of others, and there's even explicit Psukim and Yechezkel and other places that seem to indicate that the Jewish people worshipped Avodah Zarah when they were in Mitzrayim, some of them, majority of them, whatever, we don't know the exact, how many people were involved in this, but there were a number of things that they did when they were in Mitzrayim, which were not, in line with what Hashem wanted them to be doing while they were there. So at the beginning of Shemot, we have this description as the Jewish people, as the numbers of the Jewish people continue to climb and to expand and to multiply. So what does it say? It says Vayakutsu, right? Vayakutsu, the Egyptians became disgusted by the Jewish people. And the question is why? What changed? When Yosef and his family came down to Mitzrayim, everything was great. Not just great, there was a celebration, there was a party, bring everybody in to meet Paro. It was like, it was a very happy and collegial and friendly environment, and everybody seemed to be kind of getting along. So the question is, what happened? So the Beit HaLevi, on this Midrash Rabbah, in his Sefer Beit HaLevi Al HaTorah, he writes here in source number 12, that what happened is as follows. There's some psukim in Tehillim that the Midrash Rabbah are focusing on. The psukim, in short, paraphrasing the psukim, say that Hashem made his nation fruitful, it's a reference to Mitzrayim, and stronger than their enemies, reference to Mitzrayim. And then, right, Hashem turned their hearts to hate his nation. What happened? Says the Midrash, the hate was because the Jews said, Niyeh k'Mitzrayim. Let us be more like them. So what is the one feature that makes a Jew, we'll go with male here for a minute, makes a Jew very different than the rest of the world? Brit Milah. Brit Milah. Brit Milah is a symbol, it's a sign of the Brit between God and the Jewish people. And that's exactly what the Midrash says. Look in the Beit HaLevi in source 12. Zeh shamar b'midrash, kevin sheifir brit milah, hafach ha'ava, shu'ovim otam l'sina. The love, right? The original brotherhood and accepting the Jewish people into Egyptian society was turned on its head and turned into hatred. That's the quote from Tehillim. That's what happened before. There was this separation, and the Mitzrim were okay with it. The Mitzrim accepted them. You're different, and you're part of our society, and we accept you who you are. But then when the Jewish people decided we want to be more like the Egyptians, and we say, we're already here in Egypt, we're already here for this slavery experience, so let's make our lives easier and try to fit in more. Sounds like a lot of different moments in Jewish history that we could think about, right? Where the you know, the host nation and the Jewish people were being hosted by that nation, and they said, we're going to try to fit in more, we're going to change our names, and we're going to take, you know, we're going to, whatever, stop keeping this halacha and stop keeping that halacha, and very soon, you feel like you're integrated into society. But then look at what happened in Germany, right? The 1930s. Didn't matter that your name was fill in the blank, German, national, citizen, etc. You come from that line that's called the Jew, right? So it's not always so simple. And what he's alluding to here is, it worked against us. Our trying to be more like them ended up making us be hated even more. So this is just, it's fascinating because it's counterintuitive. You would think that if we make ourselves more accepted by a very specific practice, and we know the Jewish people all to get Brit Milah right before Korban Pesach, right? That's what it says in the text. You have to get Brit Milah. Why did they have to get Brit Milah? Because they didn't have Brit Milah, according to this, you know, understanding. So what happened was they did tshuva. When did they do tshuva? Korban Pesach. What did the Korban Pesach say? What was the Korban Pesach saying? We reject your Avodah Zarah, number one, and we're going to do Brit Milah. And what happened the minute they did that? Hashem turned that hatred back into the chen that he's been talking about all along.
They didn't perform Brit Milah, though. They didn't perform Brit Milah.
Before they did Korban Pesach and Mitzrayim?
I mean, that sounds like more of a halachic.
I mean, it's...
How could Avo not keep Pesach type of thing rather than like a...
Well, they didn't. You're saying they didn't do Brit Milah before they did the Korban Pesach?
Does it say that they did the Brit Milah before they did Korban Pesach?
Is it explicit? Is that what you're asking me?
Is it even implied?
Yes. Oh, a lot of midrashim speak about it.
Okay, but... Okay.
Dan Mila and Dan Pesach, they say they put on the mashkov when they were doing the... Yeah, I know. I don't want to get into the details. Anyway, the idea is that when Hashem made it such that the Mitzrim should love the Jews, what was that showing? That was showing that the Jews did tshuva. Meaning, let's get it back to that situation where the natural kind of tendency of the Mitzrim is to what? Is to show this kind of... And strange. It's hard to understand why they would want that. The Jews did so much bad to them in terms of destruction. But that was, this love was a demonstration that the tshuva of Klal Yisrael was effective. So this is what Moshe tells Paro. Look in Source 13. All of these people are going to come down, bow to me. This is also this week's parsha, right? And Moshe's kind of predicting what's going to happen at the end of the story. They're all going to come, all of your people, all of your citizens, they're all going to come and they're all going to bow down. What's that bowing down? So Rashi writes that, you know, Moshe didn't include Paro in here. Moshe didn't include Paro in here out of kavod for the king. But we know why he didn't include Paro in here. The Ramban already told us he didn't include Paro in here because Paro, Hashem wanted Paro to hate them till the last minute. Right, and he wanted Paro to come on his own. So the idea is, this bowing down was such a strong statement of get out of here. But at the same time, we're you know, this chen, this idea of the chen, and giving up all the things that they had. Now you could argue this part that I'm about to say later in history, when the Jewish people needed help militarily in the time of Babel, the rise of the Babylonian Empire, Malachim Bet, Sefer Yirmiyahu. That's the roundabout time in history. They go to Mitzrayim for help. They go to Egypt. Can you guys help us out? And you might wonder why they would be going to Mitzrayim. Now, I don't know if I want to go as far forward into history as, you know, peace treaty between the State of Israel and Egypt, but at least to that point in history where they're going to a nation who had basically enslaved them and murdered them and almost... completely wiped them out, and they're asking for their alliance, which is seemingly based on a very deep rooted relationship which started all the way when the Jewish people came down to Mitzrayim, and that's a halacha in source number 14 in Sefer Dvarim, Lo Tita'ev, right? We're not supposed to abhor an Egyptian, and there's a halacha about an Egyptian becoming convert, and the reason is Rashi brings here, right? even though they cast your male children into the river. And what's the reason you should not abhor them utterly? Because they were your hosts in a time of need. During Yosef's reign, when the neighboring country suffered from famine, therefore, although they sinned against you, do not utterly abhor them. But, and that's going on to the next pasuk already. So it's very strange, this whole thing. But afal pichein, right, the fundamental nature of Mitzrayim is to love Bnei Yisrael. We'll just finish with two last sources here, which are just interesting to think about. And to me, I struggle with them from both sides. Not sure which side to take. But the Ibn Ezra has a comment that when the Jewish people did leave, and now they're standing at Yam Suf, and they far outnumber the Egyptian army. The Egyptian army was tiny. It was a tiny band of chariots compared to a massive group of unarmed, or maybe armed, but definitely untrained Jews. But nonetheless, just by sheer number, they should have been able to overpower the Egyptian army. So he asks, Yeshli Tmoa, Echi Ra Machane Gadol Shal Shesh Miot Elef Ish Me'erod Fima Achareihem V'lama Lo Yilchamu Al Nafsham Ve'al B'neihem. Why didn't they fight? Why didn't they fight? Which is a question that bothered me when I traveled to Poland and learned about the number of Jews that were in certain camps and were in certain areas, and the number of people that were on guard, the ratio of soldiers to, and in some cases they were able to overpower, very, very few. You have stories, Treblinka, they, Sobibor, and you know, the Warsaw Uprising and things of that nature. And actually, in all three of those cases, the Warsaw Ghetto was closed, Treblinka was closed, and Sobibor, all three were closed down after the rebellion. So it was successful in a way. But the Jews here didn't fight back, and in most cases they didn't fight back. And what he writes is Hatshuvak Yemitzrim Ayu Adonim LeYisrael VeZeh Hador Yotzei MiMitzrayim LaMami Neurav LiSpol Ol Mitzrayim VeNafsho Shveila VeEchuchal Atali Lachem Adonav. So it's a little bit connected to the idea of, you know, the name, right? And the name being taken away, their identity being taken away, and what it did to them, what it did to the people psychologically, not just as an individuals, but as a group, as a nation. They didn't feel strong enough and powerful enough and motivated enough to be able to fight back. These were their masters. These were the people that were in charge of them. So even though they were far outnumbered, they were afraid of them. So just psychologically, and this is Rav Kook's point in source 16, he says the Jewish people needed to leave with the stuff of the Mitzrayim. They needed to take that with them in order for them to be able to see themselves, to break free of that enslavement mentality. And he writes, Ikara Kavanah El Yonah Shel Yitziyah Berechush Gadol, the main reason, or the main kind of Kavanah behind leaving with the Rechush Gadol, was in order to L'Ramem Et Ruach Ha'am, to raise up, right, the spirit of the people, Shenitam B'Shefel Matzav Ha'avdut Shanim Rabot. So however you want to look at why it was justified for them to leave with the belongings of the Mitzrayim, it wasn't just about, you know, the need for reparations, and we're building a Mishkan, and we're going to eventually build a state, and we're going to need resources. That was one issue. And if you want to call it gifts, you want to call it gifts, and you want to look at the perspective that the Mitzrayim, you know, wanted to give it to the Bnei Yisrael because there was this idea of Lachain. At the end of the day, in order for us to leave Mitzrayim, it's not enough to just leave there physically. There was a need for the Jewish people to leave Mitzrayim psychologically and feel that we've left that sense of slavery, of not being oppressed. So, liot am chofshi, right? In all the senses of that phrase is something that Hashem understood to be part of the tactic, the strategy of bringing these things out from Mitzrayim with us. And
didn't succeed though.
Which part didn't succeed?
The people that left Egypt never actually fully were able to become.
It's true. That's why, like, it's true.
Well, it's interesting. Just right. A very little bit of a side, but connecting back to World War II, is I'm taking this course, Economic History Post 1945, and it really touches on the fact that after World War I, the world powers strangled the Germans for reparations, and really did kill their economy by taking money out of them to like no end, and that led to hyperinflation, which led to the collapse of the market onwards to Nazism. As opposed to after World War II, they were much more laxed on the economy. In fact, the U.S. gave the Marshall Plan and the like mm-hmm. to actually boost the economy to give them the chance to become something again, as opposed to sink down.
It's interesting.
It's kind of like the flip side.
Yes. Reparations.
But yeah. Also at the same time, a number of German companies that became so successful were successful because they had like 5 to 7 years of unpaid